Rag Mama Rag. This is Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and Rag Radio, this is volume one, number two. We just started last week. Rag Radio is radio informed by the 60s Underground Press. The Rag was a 60s Underground newspaper, one of the first and most prominent of the 60s Underground Press. And it was in Austin. It was in Austin, Texas. Lasted 12 years. Now, the Rag Reality is back in force. The Rag Blog is a major internet news magazine, and Rag Radio is now on the air. I was the original editor of the Rag, and am co-editor of the Rag Blog. But what we're going to do with this radio show, we're not just a bunch of old fogies that, well. Maybe we are a bunch of old fogies, but we're not going to just be talking about the past. We're looking at how our experiences in those days as activists, as a part of that incredible rush that happened during that time, the incredible changes that were initiated during that period, how those affect what we're looking at today in this world. So that'll always be a bit of an angle. In terms of what we're doing with Rag Radio. Today, we've got as a special guest Larry Ray. Larry is a retired journalist, a video producer. He was a radio talk show host, was executive editor of a number of community newspapers. He has many honors and awards. He also is a regular contributor to the Rag blog. Larry lives in Gulfport, Mississippi, on the beautiful Gulf Coast. It's interesting because Larry and I made contact about a year ago when he started working with the writing for the Rag blog, but it wasn't until a while later that we realized that we had actually had contact in the past. We were both in a production of Dracula at Austin Civic Theater. Larry, who is as Lowell Pass of the Houston, who announced the Houston Buffaloes games, used to say, a tall can of corn, played Dracula. I was Jonathan Harker, the young fiancé, and a mutual friend, and one that many of you out there in the audience know, who we interviewed recently on Alan Campbell's People United, Gary Chasen, film director and acting coach, was the fly-eating, crazed geek Renfield. So we discovered this, Larry and I discovered this by accident. Larry, what's happening? How's the weather out there on the Gulf Coast?
It is glorious, and boy, it's sure good to be together with you on KOOP. I've been listening to some of the programming, waiting to join you on this show.
Have you been honing your soccer game?
Yeah, well, I enjoyed that. I also, the football in vivo, that's a great thing to have, because if you think we're rabid sports fans in Latin America and Italy, where I lived for so long, it's a form of insanity.
Really?
Well. And I like this song, Gracias a la Vida.
Gracias a la Vida.
The life that has given me so much. That was a great song to be playing before we both got together.
Well, we would like to talk about not only the life that has given you so much, but also some of your feelings about the life that's going on around us here in the world today, which is maybe kind of scary. But first, why don't you tell me a little bit about, you were an anchorman in Austin back in, when was that?
That was before we were called anchors. That was in about 60.
I think Walter Cronkite was the first anchor.
Yeah, that's where the term came from. But Bill Maul and I on KLRN, San Antonio, Austin, black and white, live, anchored the evening news in 63, 64, and it was pretty good spread then because it was microwaved from the studios there on the campus over to San Antonio. So we got pretty good coverage. Bill Maul later turned into be a very, very important, highly placed broadcast executive, and we're still in touch with some of the old gang. In fact, I can't call his name right now, just had a moment, but Austin City Limits is run by some of the same guys out of our class.
how was television different then? What did an anchor do, even though you weren't an anchor?
Well, first of all, you didn't have a teleprompter.
Yeah, but you never needed that kind of thing, did you?
No, you just sort of make it up. You learn to do what some of the old announcers and news people can still do. It's called a lift. And what you learn to do is to... Eye contact is important. If you don't think it isn't, try talking to someone while looking at their ear instead of maintaining eye contact, and they'll try to scoot over and get in your line of vision. So if you're just reading off paper, they're seeing the top of your head, not real compelling television. So you learn to do a lift, and that's just reading ahead and remembering four or five lines, and then, you know, diving back down and picking up some more. And that's the way we did it. Most of it was wire copy. We didn't have any big producers or that sort of thing.
What kind of staff did you have? What kind of reporters did you get out on the streets?
This basically was all...
Or was it you?
Yeah.
Were you the news?
At this time, it hadn't even gotten sophisticated enough to involve the J School there on campus.
When are we talking about, Larry?
We're talking about 62, 63, right in that area.
Yeah, that was early. That was about... I came to Austin in 63 from Houston.
Yeah.
And then later went back.
But this was pretty much it for broadcast everywhere. It was black and white. It didn't have any zingy... it didn't even have a film capability, really. We used to have what we called a film chain, and you could roll film. And voice over it. Hopefully, you'd make it all synchronized. Anyway, those were great days. Those were the formative days. And those of us who are in it look back and say, you know, gosh, what fun it was. I did live commercials for Canali Dairy down in Corpus Christi under the huge lights. The lights were, you know.
Was this before the cows in Brenham thought that Brenham was heaven? That's a bluebell.
That's right. That's bluebell. That's right. That's before those cows were even thought
of. They didn't
even
know.
But the lights back then, you had to have a whole lot of light to make a picture, so it was scorching hot. And so you'd come out of a break live and go right into the commercial, ad-libbing the commercial or something you'd memorized, and the ice cream sitting on the pedestal would be starting to melt and run over the edge. Mm-mm, good.
So you'd eat all you could.
Those were those days.
Did you went to the University of Texas at Austin, right? Did you study journalism?
Yeah, no. In fact, radio, television, film.
Radio, television,
film. And a minor in invertebrate zoo, of all things. I was starving student and had a research assistantship in the experimental science building.
The slimy network. Creatures.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Really. Well, but tell me this. When you were a kid, you know, and everybody wanted to be firemen and soldiers and stuff, did you want to be a reporter?
Absolutely.
Was that a dream?
No. I wanted to be an announcer
point.
So I would save up my money in my sophomore and junior and senior year, I guess, and take the bus from Aransas Pass to Corpus Christi. I think it was 56 cents round trip. And Colonel Tex Waters, an old classic stentorian voiced announcer, would let me read the 9 o'clock AP News Summary. You'd rip it right off of the machine and read it. And I had gone to heaven. I had a pretty decent voice, and I could talk pretty good being from Aransas Pass, and I didn't have no accent real bad.
Well, shucks. Now you got it, huh?
Yeah. And so at any rate, that's what I just knew I always wanted to do.
Tell me something. Austin, 62. How long were you in Austin? When did you leave?
I was there for 2.5 years.
2.5 years. What was it like then?
Well,
what was the feeling around?
The feeling around,
of course,
was,
Austin has become such a sort of supposed heaven on earth. You know, is such a destination now. Back then, it was a secret.
Back then, it was a totally different world. The rich kids had bleeding madras shorts. Remember that?
Yeah.
That was the sign of somebody's daddy that had bought him bleeding Madras shorts and maybe.
Well, weren't you supposed
to
keep them from bleeding, or did I don't remember how that worked?
I don't know where they did something about the fabric.
When you put it in the wash, it would bleed or something.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. But back then, everyone was pretty well focused in.
These were people who bled blue anyway, right?
They bled blue. That's absolutely correct. But we mostly were wrapped up in our studies, but then there was so much other stuff going on out there. I was in Dave McNeely's band, The Gentlemen, and we played
Dave McNeely,
rock and roll.
The writer?
Hmm?
Dave McNeely, the writer,
the
journalist?
The Texan, and the very famous award-winning journalist today.
Yeah.
Dave, he was the foreigner.
So you were in his band.
Saddle,
you were a musician, too, so you had real Austin roots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I played tenor sax and had played tenor sax all through high school and all through my 4 years of the Navy. I had just left and came right in, got there just in time for the GI Bill to have been canceled.
We'll get back to that, but now you play the pipe organ?
Yeah. Oh, that's much later. Much later.
Okay, we'll get back to the pipe organ.
Yeah.
So you got the GI Bill and you went into the military,
no,
right?
No, I didn't get the GI. I had right out of high school, right into 4 years in naval aviation, and got out right after Smiling Ralph Yarborough, Senator Yarborough, canceled the World War II GI Bill.
Oh.
So there was nothing. So I had that little stipend from the Experimental Science Building, washing glassware and doing experiments for Dr. Miniker. And Paula Craig's agency handled me. I did a nightclub act at the Club Caravel. Remember the Club Caravel?
Vaguely.
Did a magic act there and a white-faced clown walk around for trade fairs and things, anything to bring in a buck.
Yeah, I remember I did a little bit of that kind of stuff myself, mostly acting.
Yeah. Well, of course, you and I did that whole summer run there at Austin Civic Theater.
Yeah, that was an extended run, wasn't it?
And Dracula. Yeah. But, you know, all of those
it's
things
It's interesting,
today,
too, speaking of extended summer runs, there was also someone else who was in that play, a guy named Paul Ryman, and I don't remember what he played, but I had been in a production of Bernadine. As soon as I got out of high school, Mary Chase's Bernadine at the Alley Theater in Houston, and Paul, and it was a summer run. It was like one of those, it was their big summer play. And so that was my first big professional acting. Well, professional, he didn't pay me anything.
But the Alley is big now.
Oh, the
huge.
Alley was, well, it was pretty big back then.
Yeah,
even now, though it was in a little converted fan factory, you know, it's a little small arena stage, it already was building a,
you
know,
internationally
reputation.
Famous now. Yeah, and see, you were there.
I was there. And then we were there.
But you know, what's interesting and very, I think very useful for those of us who are still writing and still have active feelings about what's going on in our world around us, and particularly with our government, is to be able to look back upon, at least I try to, look back upon the way the world seemed at the time, at that age, and try to use that to help me better understand the young people of today. I've got a granddaughter who is 17, just started Loyola University in New Orleans with a full scholarship for 4 years, I must say. And her world, and trying to communicate with her and all those around them who are age 17, is a daunting challenge.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
But then you look, what I would like to know, or be able to do as effectively as possible, is to take most of those faces, that sea of people in Grant Park, for instance, in Chicago, with Obama on election night, and all of those other energized young people, certainly included an awful lot of senior citizens and older people, but the young people...
But it was really a youth movement.
It was a youth movement, and you have to ask, well, where did they go? Well, a lot of them, right, as we speak, are in front of the White House during the talks on Afghanistan that are underway with the politicians and military with the president. They're all demonstrating outside against war, and they're using a lot of the same things you and I used when we demonstrated certainly for civil rights and for integration.
but it certainly doesn't seem like it's being very effective now, does it?
Well,
and the when fairly large groups of people come out, it seems like it's easier for it to be ignored.
Or cordoned off by police.
Well, there you go.
And
the G20, for instance.
That's right.
And hundreds and hundreds. There were a lot of stories behind that. We'll be talking about that in a future show. So.
But we also have the dynamics of the time. We are in a tough time now. Thank you very much for the former administration leaving us with a $13 trillion national debt as the new administration took office. And that's where everyone's energies are focused right now. My gosh, how am I going to continue school? Or how are mom and daddy going to get the kids in school? And so the altruistic concerns have taken a back seat to being able to put bread on the table. And for a lot of folks, finding a place to live, here are educated people that were making money and had a good job, and all of a sudden, they don't have anything. Now imagine how difficult that would be. And I don't think my first priority would be to go out and protest for something of an idealistic nature. What do you think about that?
It's certainly a fascinating question. It's something we need to get back to. We need to take a break right now for a message. We're talking with Larry Ray, contributor to the Rag Blog, retired journalist, and bon vivant, an extraordinary personage. We'll be back in just a minute.
The mission of Capital Idea, a nonprofit organization, is to help working families by sponsoring educational services to improve financial stability. Capital Idea provides a GED certificate program, college readiness training, and career training. Enrollment cycles begin regularly. For more information, you may visit capitalidea.org or call 457-8610.
Okay, Larry Ray, this is Rag Radio. I'm Thorn Dreyer. It's 2:21 in Austin, Texas. Larry Ray is a retired journalist and is a frequent contributor to the Rag blog, and also has a blog called The Eye Handbill. Larry, before we talk, because I really want to talk about what's happening now in media, and talk about the internet and talk about that kind of thing. First, though, let's go back again for a moment. Tell me about your experience. You went to Vietnam as a journalist, right, and as a video or film producer. What was your experience there? And I think also be interested to know what was your experience as a journalist, and what happened with journalists then. I know you wrote about this very recently, as opposed to what happens with journalists now when they're covering a war. And also, let's talk about Vietnam and Afghanistan and comparisons. So.
Absolutely. Well, I was 26 years old and wanted to see the war of my time, and through pure serendipity, I had interviewed the Vice President of the American National Red Cross, who had come to Corpus Christi. Mr. Lewis was a wonderful man, and I didn't realize at that time that we had 5,600 Red Cross people supporting the military in Vietnam. These were former colonels and officers that were working for, you know, like $5,000 a year right out in the field with the troops. And the Red Cross was the way that you got home if mama had a head on and didn't have long to live. The Red Cross would give you the grant and set up the travel and get you out of their emergency leave top priority status and get you home, hopefully, and did all other sorts of really important human services there. We had the women in the hospitals. We had people that would send stuff over for the patients to, you know, have a nice toothbrush and some toothpaste and that sort of thing. So this was on a human level. I covered a great deal of that. We also operated refugee camps, and I spent most of my time out in the jungle doing stories, shooting documentaries that were run in Rotary clubs and everywhere all over the United States. I did several of them. And telling that story was very important.
You weren't embedded, though, were you?
No. I'll tell you about that in just a second. But also, I was a stringer for United Press International. Dirk Halstead and his wife at the time, Betsy Halstead. Dirk's a very famous political photographer today and still going. But I got a lot of my naivete taken care of real quickly by running around with people like Marley Safer and Bill Plant and Peter Arnett. And these were seasoned reporters, and you started going to the... Well, let me preface this. First of all, we operated as reporters, correspondents, accredited, DOD-accredited correspondents. We were accredited by the South Vietnamese government, and we operated under a policy of maximum candor. There's a long story about that, but basically they tried to muzzle reporters, and the New York Times created such a stink at the time.
How did they do this? How did they try to muzzle?
Well, they would tie up your teletype lines to Hong Kong, where it would be, you know, routed from there. They would complain bitterly to the bosses of the large corporations. You're acting like traitors. You're helping the godless communists we're trying to overthrow, etc.
Yeah.
At any rate, that finally got through to the military and said, hey, you know, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Let's quit fighting them and let's just give them access to everything and hope that we can, by making friends with them and that sort of thing, that they will be favorable toward us. Well, the policy of maximum candor meant if you could find a Huey helicopter or any kind of aircraft flying where you needed to go, you'd go out to the line and get to know the crew chiefs on the flight lines and say, look, you know, I run up to Nang. You got any room in there to go into Da Nang? Yeah, come on, hop on. And you carried half of my own weight in photography gear and that sort of thing, and away you'd go. Flew with Air America a lot, too.
Larry, when you were doing that, were there experiences you had that disillusioned you about what we were doing there? Were there specific things that you saw, specific things that you learned about?
Let me count the ways. We all were disillusioned, and it was a shameful farce. In the Just Pow, Joint United States Press Office, something like that, Operative Office, whatever, it was a big auditorium. It was right downtown Saigon, right by the Rex Hotel. And at 5 o'clock, you would go in, take a seat. You had the ground briefer and the air briefer. The body count was the big deal, and everything was how much progress we were making and how great we were doing. And Joe Freed from the New York Daily News had a grinding New York voice. Ah, come on, what are you doing? You know, that's not true. Well, look, tell me. You'd dive right into him. And a couple of others. And they would continue with the party line. So you knew that stuff wasn't true. I have four file drawers full of those press releases and things.
An awful lot of it got reported as they told it, though.
Well, an awful lot did, and they picked up on the body count. They were using that as the metric for how well we were doing. And that was all inflated and incorrect. But I had been up Pleiku or somewhere, and they had a search and destroy thing, mission, and I had gone out there on that. And we used the we used real heavyweight stuff against thatched roofed huts and napalmed the rice paddies and this sort of thing and just blew up this village. There was just nothing left except it was the wrong village. So when we got back,
oops.
We had a press. It was Pleiku because we had a real nice press tent there and press quarters where you could stay and a little hooch, you know, for the press to all stay together. Other times you just hit a cot if you could find one. But everybody was back saying, "Boy, what a mess up! How are they going to handle this?" And the one-star general came in, and we went up to interview him. He said, "What are you talking about?" We said, well, up luck, whatever it was, no luck village that you just wiped off the face of the earth. And he said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you wiped out the wrong village today. We all went out, and, you know, you were about three clicks the wrong direction. And he said, that's absurd. Who's giving you that information? We said, we were there. No. You weren't where you thought you were at all. We've wiped out no wrong villages. Now, we don't wipe out villages. We merely take the upper hand against the Viet Cong and the national, the NVAs that are using this to attack us. And it was this type of Alice in Wonderland.
The fearsome red menace.
Yeah, it was Alice in Wonderland talk. Yeah. So when you see that.
And more this kind of thing got reported, and it played a role I would have to say that having been involved with the underground press and with alternative media at that time, there was a time when none of this was getting reported, and really one of the few places that you could find out anything about what was really happening was through people like I.F. Stone or people like
Izzy was doing it, but
you'd find it in the alternative press, and then the mainstream or commercial media started covering things, started reporting it, and then reported more and more. Meanwhile, there was a swell of opposition in the country that started, especially on the campuses, and the media certainly was with that, but. Did the truth that got reported about Vietnam affect the way that journalists got treated in the future by the military?
Oh, absolutely.
And the effect that it has now and the way that people are able to cover Iraq and Afghanistan.
But you have been talking about the very important results of Americans going to the streets and protesting and not being cowed and just continuing to do it because it was wrong. There were no godless communists. The domino theory at the time was that if we don't take a stand here, every country in Southeast Asia will be taken over by the godless communists, and they'll topple like dominoes one after another. Of course, that was patently absurd.
Well, we've been so self-centered always as a people, as a nation, that we have no sense of history. We don't study
history.
We have no sense of the history of that region, and or we could have understood a little more about
what
was happening.
That's right. All I had to do was read Dr. Bernard Fall's Last Reflections on a War, or Street with No Joy, and that sort of thing, which told about all of it. But basically, we didn't have Hitler and Tojo and those devils anymore. The new devil was the Red Menace, which started, of course, in the 50s. I remember John Ben Shepherd, who was Attorney General, running. He was my cousin. I used to stay up there in Austin with him and my cousin Skippy, whom I haven't seen forever. But the slogans on the caravans through all the towns through Texas was democracy versus communism. And that's what it was. Now, today, the new devil is a war on terrorism. Well, you know, what
is that?
Well, that's it. But it's a war. It should be a war on terrorists. There are a few hundred really well-organized zealots out there that want to do harm to the United States. The Taliban doesn't want to do a thing to the United States. They just want to impose their version of religion over there in that area. But
we've sure done some things to help strengthen them, haven't we?
Oh, we've given them all the positive testimonials from their point of view that they could ever have wished for, kicking people's doors in, that sort of thing. But to try to stay a little bit on topic here, what happened after Vietnam, you're asking when the information started coming. It started coming
right
just about the time I got there, when Marley Safer with CBS, black and white film, had gone out on a search and destroy mission with some Marines. And they were using, he has the memorable shot of a Marine using his Zippo lighter to light the edges of a thatch roof, while the poor farmer and his wife are screaming, please, please, don't. And they burned them to the ground. And that's when it first started to become really clear that we were really messed up. We were doing the wrong thing. They talked about winning hearts and minds. We certainly didn't do that. And the enemy over there wanted nothing more than to get over war, which they had for 1,000 years, if you know the history. And the Americans showed up there just after the French, who had been mightily defeated at Dien Bien Phu in the 50s. And they called us long noses, or Ong Mop, Ong Mop, tall man. So we didn't have that devil anymore, and they certainly, after allowing Halberstam and Neil Sheehan's book, if you ever read A Bright and Shining Lie, it's a quite a read, but it's really something to see. The Cat from Way is another one by John Lawrence. John was there when I was there. But at any rate, after we finally got run out of there, and shortly thereafter, after some personal feuds and a few more people killed with the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese, it's settled down and they got right back to business, and now it's has been a bustling metropolis. They are a trading partner of the United States, just like Communist China is a trading partner of the United States.
This is Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We're talking with Larry Ray. We'll be back in just a second. Okay, we're talking with Larry Ray on Rag Radio.
Boy, did that ever bring back some memories.
Yeah, really. Larry is a retired journalist, lives in Gulfport, Mississippi now, was a broadcast journalist, and also was involved in print media, and has been a film and video producer for many years. So, you want to continue there? Or you want to talk any more about Vietnam, or shall we jump
really
on and talk
briefly
about...
Really briefly wrapping that up. So after being given maximum candor, go anywhere you want, it's up to you. If you get shot, that's the way it is. But after that, and being able to communicate how really big the error was in our presence there, and then the riots in the streets and... politicians scrambling for their political lives, knowing that this was wrong and still trying to continue it. It finally ended up the way it ended up with that memorable shot on top of the embassy with the helicopter hanging there and people clawing to get on board. And they ran us out of town.
Right.
Well, we didn't do anything again until Desert Storm. And they had already by then said, this will never happen again. We will never have reporters where they can just go wherever they want and report freely. And we haven't, and still haven't. The first time I heard, I didn't know anything about this, and the first time I heard that Karen so-and-so with so-and-so station is in bed with the...
you thought we were talking sexual harassment.
Yeah, and I thought they said in bed, and I thought, my Lord, she's a well-known reporter. How could that... And then that's when I learned about the embedding, that is stuffing you and your mind and your everything else into an operational unit. And that goes through a big screening thing. They go back and see how favorable your stories have been. If you're writing very aggressively anti-military, as to whether they even approve you're going with them. And then once you're with them, they put you with a handler and an armored personnel carrier If you're a big shot, like Leslie Wallace or some of the others that go over for networks, you've got the brass with you showing you a Temkin village there. So everything's nice and shiny. And we've never, ever had the candor that we had in Vietnam, and I doubt we ever will again.
Right. Well, thank you, Larry. The one thing that I... Larry, for those of you who are interested in hearing more, to learning more about Larry Thinks About the World, Larry Ray's articles appear regularly in the RAG blog. That's the ragblog.blogspot.com. And I was looking through some of the things that that you've written in recent times, and most of them are about your current piece, talking about some of the things we've been discussing just now, the echoes of Vietnam. You've talked about health care reform. You've talked about the wing nuts in the Republican Party. You've talked about Sarah Palin and reading Vanity Fair and resigning as governor. You've talked about those kind of things, but you also talked about, and before we go into talking about the Internet and what's happening now in the world with news and journalism, tell us about Naples. You wrote a story called Beneath Naples, talking about the parallel city under Naples that you explored, and I think is one of your loves.
I'll try to do it real quickly. That's a whole program in itself. But basically, I mentioned to you that I had been in the military, and I wound up being stationed in Naples, Italy, at the civilian airport, but they had a military, Italian military detachment on the other side of the runway, and we were on this side. And I was with a group called a radar bomb scoring unit, and they didn't want much attention attracted to it. I was a training devices man, a flight simulator, the old link trainer operator. But I was doing basically controlling our jet bombers off our carriers in over Naples to theoretically bomb 13 surveyed targets around the area with H-bombs. So I lived across the fence from the base in a real poor little Italian neighborhood and already spoke Spanish, so I transitioned to Italian pretty quickly. And that was the beginning of a lifelong love affair with Naples. I've gone back every year until the past couple of few years. And maintain those friendships, and I translate for a website over there which has to do with the sottosuolo. Now, what is a sottosuolo? That's the Italian for underground. Briefly, what happened, the place goes back to way back to the Greeks settling it, B.C., and Neapolis means new city. And they put the aqueducts in, because the whole city, which is around the curve from Mount Vesuvius, it's all volcanic, and it, instead of sitting on granite like New York City does, it sits on what's called tufo, or tough, yellow sandstone. It's real strong and easy to work. So what they would do, they would start a hole, big well-looking thing, and go down, and if you can picture looking at a bottle from the side, you know how the neck comes up, and then it starts to slope out with those shoulders, and they would make huge cavities all underneath the city, bringing up big blocks of this sandstone through the opening. And so all the villas and palaces and big buildings, these huge caverns that are, you know, 125, 150 feet below ground and just gigantic, jaw-dropping, are all underneath the city. So where you see a big, beautiful building, below it is going to be one of these caverns. And then the aqueducts that were there, they would dig just as easily long tunnels through from the cavity I've just described, where they would make a reservoir. They would coat it with lime so you could put water in it. And they would dig a tunnel to the aqueduct, divert some of the water. And you had guys that lived underground there called pozzai that spent their entire lives underground and would have the job under their son. They leave marks above these old reservoirs, sort of like brands on cattle, that showed it was their area. Anyway, it's fascinating. And in World War II, when we were bombing them incessantly, Mussolini formed a civil defense thing called UMPA. They went into these original holes where the wells, and made it like a stairwell. You've been around a stairwell that goes round and round, dun, 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 dun.
Right.
And they would dig into the sandstone or dig a tunnel at an angle with steps in it, and these were air raid shelters, and they're all over town. And then after the war, well, what would happen? People would go running down there when the siren went off, and then they'd come back up, and, hey, everything's gone. Because this isn't very far from the port of Naples, just a few blocks. So, you know, they were bombing everything. So they'd bring down a blanket and some pots and pans and this sort of thing and live down there. And then at the end of the war, they just left it, and everybody sort of forgot about it. They walled up a lot of the entrances, and the bombed out buildings, the pieces and stuff, were dropped down these huge holes and sort of like a bottomless pit for a landfill. And people completely forgot about it. And then in the 70s, Carpenter and his assistant were dumping all their shavings down a hole that went down into one of these things. And one day they said, I wonder how far down does that stuff go? And they made a nice torch out of some newspaper rolled together and held it down there, and it fell in and started a huge fire that burned for weeks. Well, you can see it going through the tunnels and through all these other areas and coming up into buildings. It was a mess. And my speleologist friend, Fulvio, worked for the Department of the Underground, which Naples has, and helped the firemen locate the source of the fire. And this was in 1972, and this was about the start of, you know, he was just a kid. They have rediscovered this underground. But being speleologists, urban speleologists, knowing how to do all the climbing gear and the ropes, and I fell into this I went down, and my gosh, their stuff just left just like it was. They had electricity, AC and DC, battery and shore power, on white insulators. That's all still down there. Benches where people would sit on the side of some of these enlarged tunnels are still there. The wood is rotting and sagging down, but it hadn't fallen yet.
It's just a giant underground museum.
It is. It is a whole different world, and we have only scratched the surface of these things. And they're all interconnected. You can walk all underneath the city through these things. And so NapoliUnderground.org is the site, and I do the English language version of it. And you know, I'm on the phone every day with my friends there. But it is definitely something to see.
Very cool. Very cool. From the past to the future. We've been talking about journal. I wanted to talk about the underground. I'd love to talk more about that. I wish we could do a whole show on it. But we were talking about your experience in journalism in the past, and we've shared a lot of that in various ways. But what's your sense of what's happening now?
Okay, I mean, real quickly.
All right, newspapers are closing.
Yep.
Bureaus are shutting down.
Yep.
People are turning to the internet to Twitter and MySpace. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any concentration, any patience. What's happening now and what's going to happen? Is the internet going to be able to legitimately fill in for the loss of our journalistic outlets? I mean, what's your feeling about what's going on now?
Thorne, you're asking all the questions that are on the pages of, I'm still a member of Sigma Delta Chi's Society of Professional Journalists, SPJ, and get their magazine. We're allowing a lot of things to happen because we don't know how to cope with the cutting down all of the trees that we've always done. We're finally reaching a point where it is fiscally not logical or good business to do that, because the cost of paper, the cost of shipping it, the pollution that puts in the air, if it's finally time to come to Jesus. You just can't do it. So major newspapers that have been there for more than 100 years are now closed. What do we get on the web? Fortunately, the New York Times web edition is very, very good. But we also have had a generation that wasn't reading a lot, Thorne, to begin with. Newspaper readership had just dropped because of television. People were getting their news from television. They were getting a lot of their local news, which really wasn't news at all. on their local radio stations. And little by little, news departments started to drop off also in regional television and radio stations. It's all happening at the same time.
I need you to hold that thought. We have to go to a quick break, and I'll be right back with Larry Ray. Okay, we're talking with Larry Ray. This is Rag Radio. This hour has flown. Continue where you were. We're talking about what's happening right now.
Well, we're talking about the change. What do we do with all the newspaper the big, wonderful newspapers closing? And what had happened prior to that, Thorne, is that large groups like the McClatchy Group, which bought our daily newspaper here in the Biloxi Gulfport, South Mississippi area, bought up bunches of these newspapers, and then the economy started to go south, and they were in trouble to begin with, and it's getting even worse. You have to say, well, what else is involved in the dynamics of not getting the news to the people? Are we just going to run to the internet? Or can they distinguish between the talking heads on CNN and Fox and the others that aren't journalists? They're opinionators, they're bloviators, someone came up with that word, and have nothing to do with objective journalism, but people aren't making the difference. Now, what does this do to the politics of the whole thing? Well, it's pretty clear, Paul Krugman just pointed this out, that the guiding principle of one of our nation's two great political parties is spite, pure and simple. If Republicans think something might be good for the president, they're against it, whether or not it's good for America. And that's so true. So if you don't have people holding their feet up to the fire and saying, hey, excuse me, that sounds really scary and bad, but there are no death panels. All of the claims that they're making. But this plays so beautifully, and watch this carefully, because conservatives and a lot of just normal folk don't want any change. They want to keep things just like the way they sort of think they are. They do not want change. That's one of the root definitions of conservatives. And ultra-conservatives will do anything to sort of hang on to what they've got. They're falling off the train now, and the train's going faster. And there's very few of them left hanging on. And so they're really screaming and saying ugly, nasty, wrong things. So if you don't have a bureau where the loudest, most vile senator is putting out this misinformation, what he's saying gets covered. It'll get covered on the talking heads.
You don't have people who are beat reporters who stay, for instance, at a bureau, at a state bureau, who have a sense of continuity, who know the story, who follow it.
Yeah.
So everything is just has no context.
And then I'll quickly here tell you about the two-headed mule. Theory of the two-headed mule. Back when the little old mud show carnivals used to come to Aransas Pass, word would get around town, they've got a two-headed mule down there. It's a fully grown, too. You got to see it. Everybody in town would go down to see the two-headed mule. And for the entire time that the two-headed mule was there, people, that's all they'd talk about, and they'd go see it. Well, that's what we have. So much of what we see on television, where they don't really claim to be journalists, or even when they do have the word news, like in CNN, headline news, incidentally, is no longer headline news. It's HLN, and it's become a Twitter-thon. So all of the objective, serious, well-researched information being given us is being strangled to death, and it's not there, and it's being replaced with two-headed mules. Because the producers are all looking at their numbers. They're not journalistically driven to say, hey, what is the quality of the news that we are presenting all across America on cable networks everywhere? No, they don't care what the quality is. The people that they have on, it's what they look like. It's There's one, Rick Sanchez, who's on in the afternoons now for CNN, is just homespun dumb.
He sure is.
But he knows how to hawk that two-headed mule coming up right after this break. We're going to do, and we want to know what you think. We want to know what you think. And they'll take some nutcase's email and put it on, and that's all being stirred up in a confused broth that a lot of folks think is news. What
well,
are we going to do
Larry,
about
here's
it?
A question. Do you think, and we're running out of time, do you think that the news media and its failures to its big time failures, for instance, to deal with the Iraq war seriously from the beginning, its inability to see the economic crash coming, lots of failings at the beginning. Do you think that it is in any way created its own demise, or do you think that it's primarily a question of finances and advertising and the internet and people's inability to concentrate for very long?
I understand the question, and my answer to that is that they have contributed mightily to a lot of the problems by not being inquisitive, thorough journalists. They are looking at their ratings, particularly in broadcast. They're looking at their ratings. They are being real careful as advertising revenue was dropping and dropping and dropping in the pages of the newspapers, not to lose that big corporate account. Now, whether they came right out and said, hey, you've got a dynamite story that nails this problem, but we just can't use it, I don't think that ever happened. But I think by the very atmosphere in which people were working and hoping to keep their job, hoping to get even more recognition, and then broadcast particularly has become a pretty... Do you see any real ugly people sitting up there night after night?
No, but see a lot of people who look like they won a beauty contest.
That's it. And so it's their rating. It's called a Q rating. How well recognized are you, and how well are we doing in the numbers? How do we do in the overnight Nielsens? Somewhere way below that, there may be some journalistic consideration. But most of the producers now are waiting to find the latest two-headed mule out there so they can get them on a jet and be the first one to get there and get a close-up of the two-headed mule.
Okay. Larry Ray and his two-headed mule, thank you so much for talking with us today. This has been great, and I wish we had, like, another hour.
Well, it's been great to visit with you, Thorne. I wish I could be live with you back in Austin again.
Yeah, well, come on down.
All right.
This is RAG Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Next week, we're going to be talking about healthcare, not warfare. There's a big rally coming up on October 17th, and my guests are going to be Reverend Jim Rigby, pastor of St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church here in Austin, and a representative of Physicians for National Healthcare Reform, or National Health Reform. So thank you for being with us today. And Larry Ray, thank you so very much.